Welcome to Conscious Voices, a weekly program dedicated to bringing you alternative points of view and to challenging popular assumptions in order to help you be better informed and civically engaged. I'm Evan Davis, your host for this edition. As this program goes to air this week, August 18th on WGRN in Columbus, or on Friday, August 19th on WCRS, there is still no agreement struck between the Columbus Board of Education and the Columbus Education Association on a contract for the coming three-year term, which starts on August 22nd. Teachers have been meeting with the board, or actually with the board's lawyers, for months ahead of the expiration of the current contract, but with little to show for it. More than 22 negotiations have thus far failed to produce an agreement that addresses the union's key concerns, which include not only wages and benefits, which the union says are not its main priorities this time around, but the decrepit state of many classrooms and school buildings, many of which are without air conditioning or have faulty or deteriorating fixtures. The teachers and some parents have been sharing anecdotes about crumbling walls, falling ceilings, water leaks, and doors and windows that don't open or shut properly. The board has promised to fix these problems in the past, but while nothing tangible has been done in the way of overdue repairs in many cases, the board has increased the superintendent's salary and allowed her to hire over 100 new mid-level administrators to the central office. The union has also upset about the school board's approval of several large tax abatements to developers and companies in the school district, foregoing millions in revenue over the next several years. The board has planned to approach the Columbus voters with a huge school levy and bond, which would raise property taxes in Columbus by some 13%. Given the negative publicity over the board's handling of the contract negotiations and increasing public scrutiny over its financial and administrative affairs, the board announced this week that it would postpone that request. Tonight, the union is holding a general membership meeting at which a vote to strike seems a likely outcome. The school board has pledged to open the schools with the so-called remote learning, that is, students with computers and sufficient bandwidth would be required to participate in day-long online classes taught by non-union substitute teachers. This, too, has angered teachers and parents alike. Here's a clip from the recent public testimony portion of the school board meeting held this past Tuesday.
Our next speaker is going to be Tanya Pompey. Please tell me if I mispronounced your name. Thank you. You will have 3 minutes to address the board.
Who are directly affected? It's us. And your unwillingness to negotiate, it's unbelievable. To quote Mark Twain, actions speak louder than words, but not nearly as often. And we see you, and we hear you. We hear your actions over your words. If you believe that our teachers are currently paid what they deserve, you cannot possibly justify your bloated salaries. If 10 of you did not show up for work for 10 days in a row, the daily operations would be minimally affected. However, if 10 teachers did not show up for work 10 days in a row, it would come to a screeching halt. The school board and administration's entitlement and self-worth is on full display. With your salaries, your retreats, your bonuses, and your benefits. Do you really fantasize that your job is more stressful than the teachers and the staff in the buildings? Based on your actions, the answer is yes. Yes, you do. Mr. James, are you hearing me? I cannot stand idly by as you attempt to push around the teachers. How can you miss that the hardest working people in this district are the ones inside the building? My daughter will speak next, and she has said one day that she wanted to become a teacher, but now she's changed her mind. She's not so sure that's a career for her. Thanks to the school board, that is now where she stands. Please know that if you cannot be part of the solution, you must accept that you are the problem. I heard President Adair's statement saying her sincere hope that the teachers' union will bargain in good faith, and I was appalled at the insinuation that the teachers are the ones who left the table. That is what we call a textbook example of gaslighting. You wouldn't return to the table. So we see through your weak attempts at damage control, and we hear your actions louder and very clear. The union members, the union leadership never left. They have been waiting on you. You gave them a take-it-or-leave-it demand, and our teachers stood firm, and I am proud of them for standing firm on the necessities of the concern for their students. You are all acting like bullies on the playground, that it's my road or the high road, and you guys took the express lane off. Remember, not giving in to a bully's demand is completely different from standing up for yourself. Imagine instead of committing wage theft by giving yourself and administration a bonus, you gave those funds to our teachers and facilities.
Thank you, Ms. Poppy. You are out of time.
I would like to close with one quote from Reverend Dr. Jackie Lewis. When teachers quit by the hundreds of thousands, the problem isn't the teachers. It's a system that doesn't value and support their work. Fund our classrooms, fix our schools, pay our teachers. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments. We will get to your daughter momentarily. Her topic was different, so we are going to talk to David Rhodes next.
Thank you for giving me the time to speak here today. My name is Inara Pompey. I am 13 years old and in eighth grade. I'm here for my teachers and my school. Ridgeview Middle School facilities, specifically the outdoor facilities, there are on average 180 students at three different times on lunch during the day, and there is one red table on the back of the school. It's nasty and wobbly and you can barely even do anything on it since it's one of the graded ones. Not every school in this district looks like the ones you show on your school montage. You guys get a six-digit salary, and our teachers average $48,000. My impression of the administration is that they are wage thieves and they should try to pay our teachers and our schools what they deserve. Fund the schools, pay the teachers. Thank you.
Thank you. And we do really always enjoy hearing our students speak. Thank you. That is hard for students to do. Thank you so much for sharing your thoughts with us. We're going to turn now to virtual speakers. Our first virtual speaker is Arshad Al-Sabah. And I know I did not say that correctly, so please correct me. And here, these two speakers are also here to talk to us about negotiations. You have 3 minutes to address the question. Go ahead.
Yes, my name is Arshad El-Sabor, and I have a scholar who attends Indianola Elementary School. Last year, over 250 teachers quit and left the district. This is an issue. Last year was also the most violent year on record for Columbus Public Schools, where one high school in particular had to assign the children clear book bags due to the violence in the school. You have an issue with morale and also an issue with tending to your employees. On Glassdoors, which is the leading employer reviewer in the United States, it states that 46% of your employees would not recommend working at Columbus Public Schools to a friend. Your positive outlook rating has decreased by 17% over the past 12 months. Down to 37% of your employees have a positive outlook for Columbus City School. These are serious issues. I mean, I'm looking at stats, and this is why I wanted to present 130 new administrator jobs, or 42.2% increase since Dr. Dixon was hired as the superintendent with these new administrative jobs. The majority of the jobs pay over $100,000. Dr. Dixon's salary is $267K with an $800 allotment for car and $150 technology allotment a month, plus bonuses. And she was given an 8.5% increase for inflation as it relates to her salary. But yet the teachers have not received this type of adjustment for inflation. Your certified teachers do not qualify for tuition reimbursement when most companies offer these benefits to increase their workers' intellectual abilities and productivity. Why is tuition reimbursement only provided to management or classified employees? And also, too, I was on the internet, and there's a list of the top paid employees in the district, 100 paid employees in the district for 2019. As I'm researching this information, there are no teachers listed in the top 100 paid employees in 2019. And I'm also looking to do a public record request for 2021 and 2022 regarding top paid employees. How is this sustainable as a business? I mean, the question I'm having for you is that the police officers in Columbus department, they make 100K in 5 years without a college degree. With the dynamics of teaching becoming extremely more hazardous for employees, is it fair that the teachers with master degrees in your district start at 55K? When I contrast, the cop with only a high school diploma can make 100K after 5 years of employment. What are you doing as a district to add satisfaction, morale, and economic mobility to your teaching workforce? I mean, and this is just my personal opinion. I believe that this is keeping the teachers in a cycle of poverty.
Thank you so much for your comments, sir. Your time is up. We do appreciate your time. I know it's hard because you can't see me. We do appreciate your comments. Your time is up. Our next virtual speaker is Rachel Wheeler, and it'll take a moment to get her. Ms. Nichols, is the caller on the line?
President, are the callers on the line?
Ms. Wheeler, you have three minutes to address the board. You may begin.
Hello, and thank you, board, for allowing me the time to speak. My name is Rachel Wheeler, parent to a rising first grader at Clinton Elementary. My goal in speaking tonight is to urge the board to continue to negotiate in good faith with the teachers' union. I understand that money and resources are not unlimited, but without discussion, there can be no forward progress. Additionally, one of the items that the teachers are negotiating for are for safe and healthy school conditions. Frankly, I'm not sure why that is even an issue that they have to quote-unquote negotiate. A safe and healthy teaching and learning environment should be a given for all teachers and students. If there are differences to what this means to different individuals, a neutral third party should be appointed to make that determination and should be subject to budget or up for negotiation. My final point is that if the board and teachers union have not reached a deal at the start of school should be delayed. Remote learning with substitutes is not an adequate alternative to schooling for any ages, but particularly not for our younger kiddos. Remote learning is an alternative only in situations of public health and safety, like the COVID-19 crisis the past few years. This is not that. There is no benefit to the students by starting the school year remotely with substitutes. The only benefit would be to the school district and federal funding, and that is not right. I request that you negotiate fairly with the teachers union so we can start this school year off right, and in the alternative, delay the start of school so we can start this school year off right, even if a few days later, weeks, whatever it takes. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much, Ms. Wheeler. And that concludes our public comments. The last thing on our agenda is a motion to adjourn.
Motion to adjourn.
Second.
Motion and a second. And without objection, we are adjourned.
We will certainly keep you up to date on the story as it unfolds. I want to devote the majority of today's show to author Salman Rushdie, who was brutally attacked at a literary festival in New York last week and remains hospitalized in critical condition after being stabbed by an assailant nearly a dozen times. Mr. Rushdie often engages in social commentary through his writings and speeches and interviews, and has been critical of religions and governments alike. His novel, Satanic Verses, is a multi-layered critique of the way new ideas are socialized in society, and he used fictional character interactions between historic characters to convey his thesis. One of those characters in this tale was Muhammad, the 6th century priest whose writings and those of his wives and mistresses form much of the liturgy for the Islamic faith. That upset many Muslim clerics, including Iran's former Ayatollah Khomeini, who issued a fatwa, or bounty, calling for Mr. Rushdie's assassination. For nearly 20 years, Salman Rushdie lived in seclusion and avoided public appearances, except for an occasional in-studio media interview. Lately, however, he'd begun to feel more secure and had gradually resumed his public life until last Friday when he was to appear as part of a panel of authors at a literary festival in New York and was attacked by a man wielding a knife who leapt on stage from the audience, causing life-threatening injuries to the 75-year-old Rushdie. We have next an interview from just a few months ago titled Living in the Rubble of Truth.
Salman Rushdie needs no introduction. He's the author of 14 works of fiction, but he's more recently the author of this book, Languages of Truth, essays written between 2003 and 2020. It's a tremendously good read. You can buy it online if you're watching at home, if you're watching around the world online, or you can buy it here in the bookshop in the fire station after the event. Please welcome Salman Rushdie. Salman, you reveal at the very end of the book that while you were sitting out the pandemic at home in New York City, you caught COVID-19 at the age of 72 and with a long-standing underlying condition, asthma. It must have been tremendously frightening for you.
Well, yeah, it was, because it was right at the beginning of the pandemic. It was in the middle of March of last year. And at that point, none of us, I think, really understood what this thing was. And so it had the fear of the unknown, you know, that it, this thing arrived and it changed the lives of everybody in the world literally overnight. I ended up being very lucky because I didn't have the worst of it, you know. And the thing that kept me out of hospital is that it didn't affect my breathing. And my blood oxygen level was okay. I mean, I had all the other stuff, you know. I mean, I had high fever and I had a cough and I had aches and pains and et cetera, et cetera. But I was able to stay out of hospital. And at that moment, when even doctors didn't know really how to treat this thing, people were essentially going to hospital to die, you know. And I was fortunate that I had a very, very good doctor. So many of us can say in this last year and a half that we owe an enormous amount to the doctors who treated us or who guided us. And I had a terrific one who called me every day and asked me a series of questions about my health, and on the basis of that, basically told me stay home and tough it out, and that's what I did.
You, it's quite a short essay at the end of the book about the pandemic, and you talk about somebody who we both knew, Susan Sontag, who wrote a book called Illness as Metaphor after recovering from cancer. And there's been quite a lot of metaphorical thinking during this pandemic as well, which is very, in your account of it, very bad thinking. What do you mean by that? What is the metaphorical thinking?
Well, the great thing about Susan's famous book is that she said illness is not a metaphor, illness is an illness. Instead of treating it as a sign of doom, or a kind of indication from the gods that we should change our ways, or any of the things that were said about this pandemic and have been said about the plague in the past and so on, that's just the wrong way to look at it. What you need to look at it as is as people being very unwell and needing to be treated and needing to get well. Treat illness as illness. I must say, I remember that essay I remembered it very often in the last year and a half, and I think it's very wise.
I was kind of reassured to read your account of it, because last year during the first lockdown, I kind of beat myself up a bit for not achieving anything particularly creative with all this spare time. But you said something similar happened to you. You found it quite hard to work. The sentence, the roar of the real world was deafening and left no quiet space in which an imagined world might grow. And I thought, well, if it happened to Salman Rushdie, I don't feel so bad that I didn't achieve anything.
You know, I just think that the scale of the tragedy was so great that it was very difficult to say, let me make up a story, you know. And it took me a while. But in the end, I did get back to it. And that, of course, helped me to get through it. But yeah, I mean, I think it was overwhelming as an experience for all of us. I mean, I think one of the things I think is we all know this because it happened to every single one of us. You know, this feeling of being overwhelmed by this colossal global tragedy. And then being in many ways very angry about the way in which it was handled. And certainly here in the United States, it was handled very, very badly indeed.
And one of the reasons I wanted to start our conversation with this was that it's shone a very unforgiving light on the state of the United States and indeed some of the other democracies that we consider to be secure and entrenched. And one of the aspects of that it's highlighted is the division into two separate Americas that no longer have a shared public reality. It's not just that they disagree about the available facts, they don't even have shared available facts. That's been evident in the way the two Americas have responded to this pandemic, isn't it?
Yeah, well, it's because it was politicized, you know, and which is just an absurd thing, you know, because the pandemic actually, the coronavirus doesn't care how you vote, you know, and it doesn't affect your likelihood of getting it or not, depending on whether you're on the left or the right, you know, but it was heavily politicized. And even right now, when parts of the United States are doing very well and other parts are doing very badly in their response to the pandemic, the places which are the kind of Trumpier places of America, in a way, don't want to be vaccinated because they see that as giving in to the liberals. You know, in some way, they would be doing what the hated libs want them to do. And that's just an insane way of looking at a health crisis. You know, but that is where we are.
And how has it happened, do you think, that these two Americas now gaze at each other in mutual incomprehension and indeed rage across an ever-widening gulf?
Well, the gulf was there before Trump, but one has to say that it was enormously deepened during the years of the Trump administration and goes on being deepened by large quantities of the Republican Party that won't accept the result of the last election. You know, so, which actually any independent observer would say and did say that this was one of the fairest, best scrutinized, most honest elections ever. And yet there's a substantial chunk of the United States that believe it was fixed. The rift in reality didn't begin with Trump, but it was colossally deepened by him.
The book is called Languages of Truth, and you talk about different conceptions of truth and how quite often fiction, which declares its fictionality up front, the contract between the fiction writer and the reader is the fiction writer says, this is a made-up story, but I depend upon you to suspend your disbelief. And the reader comes in and says, I will suspend my disbelief. I will believe the story, even though you've declared it to be fiction, because I believe I will learn a different kind of truth from it, a truth from untruth. That seems to me very important. It's a theme that runs all the way through this book.
Yeah, I remember in the early days of the pandemic, I remember people saying, you know, why at a time when there is when there are so many lies around, you know, why do you want to make things up? You know, aren't you just adding to the problem, so to speak? And I remember, I think Margaret Atwood said something, I'll paraphrase it, but what I think she was getting at was that fiction and lies are not the same thing. That literature, actually, whatever techniques it uses, whether realistic or fantastic, is trying to tell you some kind of truth about human nature, about the kinds of people that we are and why we do the things we do and why we build the societies we build and what happens to them, what goes wrong and what goes right. Literature is about trying to reach for those human truths, you know, and the techniques, as I say, are completely secondary. It doesn't matter whether it's science fiction or fantasy or kitchen sink realism. And all of that is trying to aim towards the truth, whereas the lie, of course, is a way of obscuring the truth.
One of my working life as a foreign correspondent and as a reporter more generally has been dedicated to the conviction, it's been built on the conviction, that there's something called the truth and that it's knowable and verifiable, and that once it's been verified, it can be established to a high degree of satisfactory proof. That idea now, for the first time in living memory, is under very, very serious assault. The idea of evidence, the idea of reasoned argument is now under assault from very, very powerful quarters. You deal with this in the book. How dangerous is this for the survival of something we all took for granted until very recently, which is to say democracy?
Well, it is the crucial thing that needs to happen in order to destroy democracy. Because if there is no longer any consensus, not only about the truth, but about how you arrive at the truth, then it makes it possible for somebody to stand up, as dictators often have, and to say, everybody else is lying to you, I am the truth. And that moment at which you believe in the individual rather than in, as you say, the processes of the truth, establishing the truth, evidence, etc. That's the way in which authoritarianism begins. And here in America, on January the 6th of this year, we came within a few millimeters of that assault on democracy succeeding. I think, because it didn't succeed, and because some of the people involved looked like almost comic grotesque figures, with Viking horns on and so on, it may be easy for people not to understand how close we came. But this was as close as the most powerful democracy in the world came to becoming something else. And so it showed the fragility of the system. And that fragility continues.
I was on this stage the other day with the outgoing New York correspondent of the BBC, a man called Nick Bryant, who's a tremendously good and brave journalist. And I put it to him that the institutions of American democracy had done their job, that the American democracy had survived because the institutions were strong. And he said to me, I wish I could be as optimistic as you, because imagine what would have happened if both houses had been controlled by Trump loyalists. So do you think it was very close?
Yeah, I think, look, during the election, when the election was under enormous assault by Trump and his cronies, all around America, there were election officers, many of whom were Republicans, some of whom were Trump appointees, who defended the election and would not buy into what is now being called the big lie. They said, no, this is a fair election. I'm standing here with our workers, and they have done a wonderful job, and this election is credible. And that happened in states from Arizona to Wisconsin to Georgia to across the country. And those officials saved us because they did not go along party lines. They broke with the party line and simply did their job. Now, those officials have since the election been under colossal attack. And several of them have either willingly or unwillingly given up their positions. And we don't exactly know who's taking their place. And we don't exactly know if what happened this time will happen next time. Because if the personnel had been different, things would have been very difficult. So yes, the institutions held up, but they only just held. And with a few different individuals in different positions, the system could have failed. And I think that is something we all have to be very aware of.
The book is very trenchant in its defense of the values that you've been associated with all your writing life. But it's also very personal and even intimate in places. And one of the things that struck me very early on in the book is that it reminded me of Picasso saying, "It's taken me a lifetime to learn to paint like a child." You have a very enduring capacity for wonder, which lights up right at the start of this book. Where does that come from?
Well, I think it comes from growing up in India. I think it comes from, or at least it begins there comes from growing up in a world where your great gift is this storehouse of fantastic tales. You know, some of them epic, some of them animal fables, all sorts of wonderful stories that you first come across in child versions, although many of them were not actually written for children. I mean, The Thousand and One Nights is not written for children. It's a very adult book. But there are children's versions of it. So you grow up with this wonderful environment which teaches you, or taught me anyway, something about the beauty of fictionality, the fact that fiction should actually be fictional, come from the imagination and not just from observation. And I mean, you need both, but I think the realist tradition privileges observation over imagination. In my view, both those things are essential. So it started there. I mean, then, you know, I remember when I first came to England and was at school, I was a huge science fiction addict. And I just read industrial quantities of science fiction. And then at a certain point stopped. But I think it left its mark. So I think being in the camp of the writers who believe in the use of who believe in highly imagined fiction, I have great admiration for the writers of the other kind. You know, and I've often felt that if I had had the kind of life of someone like William Faulkner, who was deeply rooted in one little corner of the world and was able to make a lifetime of work out of his knowledge of that little corner, I mean, I have great kind of envy for that, but my life's been somewhat different, and so the way the books come out is also different.
Yeah, so reading this book, it's a bit like being invited backstage into one of the great creative imaginations of our age. You get to see the anatomy and physiology of Salman Rushdie's imagination. It's a great experience just immersing yourself in seeing how this imagination works. And one of the things you talk about, Salman, is you say, for me, the fantastic has been a way of adding dimensions to the real. You break down the barrier between the real and the fantastic in order to show us that what we mistakenly view in our lives as ordinary can often, in fact, be extraordinary. And you seem to be holding out the argument, making the argument that fiction has a kind of, not just a transformative power, but even offers transcendence in some way, enables us to become someone else almost while we're reading.
Well, I think one of the things I do think is true. Yes, I think it allows us to enter into the interiority of people who are not like ourselves. And I think that's enormously valuable. And in this age, when I think we live in an age of great translators, you know, and as a result, we have available to us not just the world of our own language, but the world of a world of languages. And I've always been found great inspiration in works that I've only read in translation. You know, books that I've read, books which were written in Spanish or Russian or Japanese or whatever it may be. You know, and I think that's a great gift that literature gives us. It gives us the world. It gives us the inner reality. You know, you look at Afghanistan on the news, and you see what the news has to show you. You see explosions and horror. If you read the literature about Afghanistan, you begin to have some sense of the lived experience of what it's like to be there, be a person there, be a person from there, and literature can give us that, you know, and that's a colossal gift.
You've got a knocker on the door of your study, in the shape of Shakespeare's head, Shakespeare's face, and you say, William Shakespeare is the owner of the domain to which the knock admits me. What do you think you owe to? What do you think we all owe to William Shakespeare?
Well, all right. How long have you got? Yes. Well, one thing I think is that the classical tradition in English is different from that in, for example, French. Now, if you look at the classics in French, if you look at, you know, Racine, Corneille, Molière, etc. One of the things they say is that a work of art can only be one thing. You know, a tragedy can't be a comedy, and vice versa. What Shakespeare does is to show us that everything can be everything at once. You know, so I mean, I used somewhere in the book the example of Hamlet. You know, that Act One, Scene One is a ghost story, and it progresses from being a ghost story to being a political story about intrigues at the court of Denmark, to being a love story, to having comic scenes, and going to being a revenge tragedy, and goes back to being a love story at certain points and back to being a ghost story at other points. And what Shakespeare makes possible is for us to imagine that all those different things can cohere into a single whole. In other words, that the book or the play can contain like a multitude. And that's an enormous gift, I think, to allow us to think like that.
You spent the first 14 years of your life in India, and then you came to Great Britain as a 14-year-old schoolboy. So the migrant's experience has been the backdrop to your creative work. To some extent, we live in the age of migration. How do you think, I mean, it's a huge question, and you could probably talk for a day on it, but how do you think, in a nutshell, the migration experience has shaped the writer you are?
Well, I think it's everything, you know. It's entirely at the heart of the writer that I am, because it's first of all not just enabled me but obliged me to consider how the world joins up, you know, how the world over here connects to the world over there, and that we don't any longer live in separate little boxes, that all our boxes flow in, open up into each other's boxes. And the act of journeying across the world and living in different parts of it, first of all, gives you some insight into that, and secondly, obliges you to talk about it. And I think, you know, to live in one of the great cities of the world now, whether it's Bombay or London or New York, is to see the consequences of migration, because these cities are created by the phenomenon of migration. You know, you walk down the streets of Manhattan and you hear every language in the world. You know, you hear people talking about histories from literally. You get into a taxi, and you hear about, I don't know, Azerbaijan. You know, and so that plurality of experience, that plural society, is the creation of this, what you and I've also called it, the age of migration. Of course, we now live in a time in which there's been a degree of suspicion about migration, you know, and hostility towards it. And I feel the need to speak back against that. And one of the things that actually really pleased me was to read, when I learned that the two scientists in Germany who developed the Pfizer vaccine were Turkish immigrants, husband and wife team of Turkish immigrants. So, Germany has had its issues about Turkish immigrants. And it is kind of rather beautiful that this community, which is sometimes treated badly, has produced the husband and wife team who have, to put it simply, saved the world.
But you say that you've always envied writers like Eudora Welty and William Faulkner for the depth of their roots, because they can spin an entire life's canon out of a single rooted place, and your experience is the opposite of that. And because one of the points you make is that if you're a migrant, you don't know what ground you're standing on until you invent it. And migrants are required not just to self-interrogate, but to self-curate to some extent. What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, I remember V.S. Naipaul's novel, The Enigma of Arrival, talks about that. It talks about the phenomenon of arriving. You know, and when you arrive, you don't know the ground you stand on. You don't understand where you stand in the society. You know, migration often rips up all the roots of the self. You know, the self is rooted in, for example, the language that we speak, or the belief system that we have, or the community that we are familiar with, etc. You know, and migration gets rid of all of that, and suddenly you have to start again. You have to decide what to absorb from the world to which you've come, what to retain from the world that you came from. You have to, you know, what do you discard? What do you assimilate? How are you to be in this new world? You know, it used to be in America, you know, in an earlier time, that people migrating from Eastern Europe would say to their children, "Don't speak the old language. Speak English." You know, they would try and make themselves new people in the new country. Now there's a somewhat different attitude where migrant communities, to my mind, quite rightly, want to insist on their identities. You know, but it's a question, and that question, of course, is an existential question, that whether you're a migrant or not applies to you. How do you see yourself? How do you tell yourself who you are, and how do you tell the world who you are? And how do we live in the world? You know, and that's a question that migrants have to answer from the moment of the act of migration.
The book's quite funny about your early attempts to become a published author, which were not initially very successful.
Not at all.
And you found your perfect little garret flat in West London, and stuck at it. You had a job as an advertising copywriter part time to pay the rent, and one of the was go to work on an egg. Yours.
No, go to work on an egg was Faye Weldon's.
Okay, so your one was, and I saw this, I saw a version of this the other day. You wrote a very successful advertising line for the Aero chocolate bar, which yes. included the words like irresistible.
Yes, Adora Bubble, yes.
And you, Adora Bubble, yeah. But you resisted their attempts to offer you, well, they tried to lure you to work for them full time by offering you large salaries, but you stuck with the dream of becoming a fiction writer. You know, it must have taken quite a bit of self-belief to stick with it. Were you ever tempted to, did you come close to giving it up?
Yeah, I mean, I did, because, you know, I didn't have one of those starts that a number of my contemporaries had. You know, if you look at the early careers of people like, you know, Ian McEwan and Martin Amis and so on, they took off like a rocket. I mean, they were in their early 20s. They had already established who they were as writers, you know, and that didn't happen to me. I mean, by the time Midnight's Children came out, I was getting on for 34 years old. You know, so. And I left university at 21. So so there's like 13 years in there where I was watching everybody of my age going off like a rocket all around me, you know, and wondering if that would ever happen, you know. And yes, I was tempted. But I'm actually, if I look back, I'm quite proud of that young person to stick at it, you know. I do think that Midnight's Children was kind of Hollywood or bust. I mean, I remember when I finished it, thinking that as far as I could tell, this was a good book. But if nobody agreed, then maybe I should just write the advertising copy.
You know? Let me ask you to describe how Midnight's Children came about, because you had a previous published novel, which you say in the book has quite rightly fallen into obscurity. Yeah. But you got a £700 advance for it, and you used that £700 to go to India and travel around India cheaply, and you were there for months. And you describe it as a second healing, the first healing being Cambridge after your experience of racism at your secondary school. Cambridge was the opposite. Cambridge was a great healing experience and introduced you to a different kind of England. And in what sense was going to India in your late 20s a healing experience?
Well, it was just the business of reclaiming it for myself, you know. I mean, having at that point spent, you know, 5 years at rugby school and 3 years at Cambridge, really away from India, apart from occasional visits, having been away for 8 years, I feared that I was losing my connection to it, you know, and I didn't want to, you know. And so, yeah, £700 in 1973 was worth a lot more than £700 is now. You know, you could certainly, I think, put a zero on that. And I just took the whole thing and went to India and traveled as cheaply as I could for as long as I could, both to places that I had known very well, like like Bombay, where I grew up, and still Bombay at that time, not Mumbai. And I already had in my mind the idea of writing some kind of panoramic Indian novel. And so I went to places that I knew I would want to write about, and I went to some places that I'd never been that I thought I might want to write about, you know? like Benares, for example, which did in the end find its way into the novel. I came back from that experience and started writing.
And it took you 5 years to write Midnight's Children.
Yeah.
And it made you an overnight superstar. It won the Booker Prize, and it made you a household name in the English-speaking world, in literary circles. And sometimes the book reads like a dialogue between you, age 73, and your younger self. And I was remembering today that Norman Mailer wrote an introduction for a 50th anniversary edition of The Naked and the Dead, in which he said, you know, I'm still proud of it. I was 24 when I wrote it, but when I read it now, 50 years on, in my 70s, it reads like the prose of a much younger and unfinished writer. He said, for example, there's scarcely a noun that's not holding hands with the nearest available adjective. And I wonder, when you look at Midnight's Children now, what you think of it?
Well, first of all, that's probably the only example on record of startling modesty from Norman Mailer. But yeah, of course, when I look back at it, I think I don't write like that now, you know. And there are bits of it which surprise me into happiness, because I think they are good. And there are other bits where I think, well, you know, maybe I wouldn't do that now. But I think one of the absolute errors is to think that you can ever revisit an old book and improve it. You know, I think there's a wonderful line that I've always liked by the American literary critic Randall Jarrell, who says a novel is a long piece of writing that has something wrong with it. And I think that's true, in the sense that perfection is impossible. You know, if you write what that book is, almost 250,000 words long, you know, and if you write anything of that length, perfection is a pipe dream. It never happens. And I mean, what you do is you try and get as close to it as you can, but you accept the fact that there will be things which are less than perfect about it, you know, and I think that's true of everything that everybody writes, you know. So there have been one or two people who've had a go at improving old books. I remember John Fowles had a go at revising The Magus. And I mean, it didn't make that big of an impression on anybody. You know, it didn't really seem to be a big improvement. Who was it? Auden rewrote a poem or two of his and almost always made them worse. So I think, yeah, you just have to... I mean, my view is you have to leave it alone, because when you write a book, when I write a book anyway, an enormous amount of it is held in my head. I mean, it doesn't matter how many pages of notes or files I've got. A lot of the, you know, the kind of spider's web of the book, of how everything connects to everything else, is just in here, you know, and remains there all the time that you're working on the book. But at a certain point when you finish the book, it goes, you know, it's not there anymore. It has to go in order to make room for the next thing. After that, if you try and go into the book, it's like performing brain surgery blindfolded. You know, you can't do it and mustn't do it.
I want to ask you about your friend, the late Christopher Hitchens.
Yes.
He wasn't a particularly close friend when the beginning of the darkest part of your life, the most difficult part of your life, started. But he became a close friend during that period.
Yes.
The way he responded to your predicament 30 years ago was different to the way many of his friends on the left behaved. What was it about the way Christopher Hitchens responded to that episode that made you write about him the way you write about him?
Well, you know, Christopher never did things by halves. You know, he was not a kind of on the one hand, on the other hand kind of person. He decided what he thought, and he went for it 200%. You know, and that was his nature in all things. And in this case, I mean, actually, we separately, without conferring, said almost exactly the same thing about what happened to the Satanic Verses, where he said that he found that everything in his life that he admired and revered was on one side, and everything that he detested and loathed was on the other side. And so it was easy for him to see which side he should be on. And I must say, I felt more or less the same. He made himself closer to me in order to be more helpful, you know. And I mean, there's just one moment, the moment at which the British government finally decided it might be a good idea for me to meet with the President of the United States, and that was Bill Clinton, and partly helped to set it up. But one of the people who really helped to set it up was Christopher Hitchens, because he was very friendly with some of Clinton's closest aides, notably George Stephanopoulos. And he persuaded George to persuade Clinton to do the right thing. And then that happened. And actually, when I was in the White House having the meeting with the president, Stephanopoulos called Christopher and said, "The eagle has landed."
You know, when I was reading that your account of your relationship with Christopher Hitchens, and you say that your predicament, I'll quote, made Christopher understand that a new danger had been unleashed upon the earth, a new totalizing ideology to step into the downhill shoes of Soviet communism. I think the rest of us in the early 90s were still living with what you might call the Fukuyama delusion, that liberal democracy had won, it was the end of history, liberal democracy would now become the default position of all humankind. You were living the future. You were living our future at that time, in a sense, because you could see very starkly, because it constrained you in a very dangerous way, that there were real dangers out there that were not going to be susceptible to liberalisation. And the rest of us caught up with that many years later.
Yeah, I mean, I think actually it's just that people weren't paying attention, because it was there to see. You know, the thing that happened to me was not by any means the first thing of that kind that happened. You know, there had been similar attacks on writers and intellectuals and, you know, dissenters across the Islamic world for a long time before that. You know, and the Islamic Revolution itself had been, you know, to say the least, brutal. So if one was looking in the right direction, one could have seen it coming. You know, it's just that people were not looking in that direction. You know? In the same ways, I think we could have seen the current rise of a kind of anti-intellectual populism. We could have seen that coming.
We could have, but we didn't. And you write about Philip Roth, actually, in his book, The War Against America, in which he writes about it. It's a kind of alternative history in which Charles Lindbergh, the aviator, becomes president. He defeats President Roosevelt. America stays out of the Second World War, turns in on itself, and Charles Lindbergh becomes this populist leader. He was the first to use the slogan America First. And so there were clear, but this was a long, long time before, this is about 12, 14 years ago that Philip Roth published that book. And you said that when you read it, although you admired the book, you thought, nah, it's far-fetched, it can't happen here. So even you didn't see it coming.
No, I thought, no, Philip, I don't buy it. You know, not possible to happen in America. And you know, he was right and I was wrong. It obviously, there's even before Philip Roth, there's Sinclair Lewis, his book called It Happened Here. So there have been attempts, imaginative attempts, to imagine the destruction of American democracy. You know, but we don't have to imagine it anymore.
I want to ask you a related question before I throw it open to the floor and to the online audience, and it's connected to what's happened in America, and it's not directly about the book, it's about events this week. This seems to many of us a very momentous, even pivotal week with what has happened in Afghanistan. What do you make of that?
I mean, words fail me, really. I think it's an appalling event. I understand a political argument which says we've spent trillions of dollars, we can't go on running this other country forever. But the catastrophe that will now unfold, which was entirely predictable, is a moral fault which will haunt, I think, and somebody I admire, which is Joe Biden. And you know, since I think it's 57 years, the Americans have had close to 30,000 troops in South Korea, presumably to protect it against communism. The various groups that have been surveying the Afghan situation have said, roughly speaking, that 4,500 American troops remaining in Afghanistan would have been sufficient to stabilize the country and to prevent this calamity from happening. So I need somebody to answer that question. Why is it okay to put 28,000 people into South Korea for half a century without anybody ever saying, what are they doing there?
We've lived our lives in the post-1945 architecture of the rules-based liberal order underpinned by American power. Do you think that's coming to an end?
I think it has come to an end, yes. I mean, I think what used to be called the Pax Americana, you know, it doesn't exist anymore. I think America doesn't want it. America doesn't want to be the world's policeman anymore. And hasn't been very good at it when it's tried. I think, you know, people said about the 20th century that it was the American century. Well, the 21st certainly is not.
There are many, many more questions, Salman, both from the floor here and online, but we're out of time. It's been a fascinating hour. I've enjoyed it hugely. Thanks again to the Royal Bank of Scotland for sponsoring the event. Don't forget, you can buy the book at the virtual bookshop if you're watching it online. Click on the bookshop icon, and you can buy the book if you're live here in Edinburgh in the bookshop outside. And Salman, unfortunately, is not here to sign his books, but he's here in spirit. I hope we get you back in the flesh soon, Salman. I've enjoyed this hour immensely. I hope you have. Thank you very much indeed.
Salman Rushdie, who as of this broadcast is still in critical condition, but who is expected to survive. We wish him a full recovery, as full as possible. And this has been Conscious Voices, heard each week at this time in your community radio stations, WCRSLP 92.7 and 98.3 FM, and WGRNLP 94.1 FM in Columbus, Ohio. I'm Evan Davis, and I'll be with you again next week for another edition. Take care. The program you are listening to is broadcast both on community radio station WCRS via translator W245AY at 98.3 FM and on WGRN 94.1 FM, WCRSFM.org and WGRN.org. If you like what you're hearing or want to get involved, please visit those websites and give what you can. Both stations are non-commercial and volunteer-run. Both stations depend on listener support. Again, the websites are WCRSFM.org for WCRS and WGRN.org for WGRN.
This is Professor Howard Zinn. The independent, non-commercial radio station you're listening to is really important in the maintenance of democracy. Thomas Jefferson once said, an informed democracy will behave in a reasonable manner. So if you care about being informed, if you care about democracy, if you're a reasonable person, you are, of course, please support your source for uncensored news and views and the voice of your community.
Time when the operation of the machine becomes so odious, makes you so sick at heart, that you can't take part, you can't even passively take part, and you've got to put your bodies upon the gears and upon the wheels, upon the levers, upon all the apparatus, and you've got to make it stop, and you've got to indicate to the people who run it, to the people who own it, that unless you're free, the machine will be prevented from working at all.
You're listening to WGRN 94.1, Columbus Community Radio, The Green Renaissance.